And welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me. As per usual, can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. So I am Dr. Karen McLaughlin. I am a clinical midwifery specialist, still working, still catching babies at the John Hunter at New England Health. But I'm also a midwifery academic and researcher working at Newcastle University. And I'm a mother. I have two grown-up daughters and a husband, and yeah.
It's what we are well-rounded people. It's not just what we do for the job.
That's
it's
exactly
also who
right.
we are outside of the job. So how did you get into midwifery?
So midwifery, I obviously I started nursing first because that's the only way you could do it back then anyway, 30-odd years ago. And so I did my nursing and discovered very quickly that I didn't like sick people at all, and particularly old sick people.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, no, we don't like this. But I always knew that I wanted to work with women and children. I worked in pediatric nursing for a little while, with pediatric oncology, actually, which was obviously amazing but harrowing at the same time. And so, again, I needed to, work where things were a little bit, happier,
yep.
I guess.
Yep.
So then I went into midwifery and absolutely haven't looked back. So I did a graduate diploma in midwifery I've worked in all areas of midwifery since. So I've worked in group practice, I've worked in antenatal, postnatal, birthing suite, and education, like clinical midwifery educator as well, district midwifery educator, all types of different areas. So yeah, so it's served me well, I have to say.
So you're still working now. What model of care are you working now?
Yeah, I'm still catching babies on weekends, and still teaching. I teach antenatal classes as well, so I'm a sessional parent educator as well. So I work full-time at the uni, catch babies on weekends and teach antenatal classes of a night time.
When do you have time off?
Yeah, no, there's no time off.
Is that because you just really enjoy what you do?
Well, I guess I don't know. I like different aspects of all of those things, and I can't kind of give up any of them at the moment, which is tricky. Yeah. So I guess there'll come a time where I'll have to give up something, but until then I'll just keep trying to do it all. But, yeah, but it's probably it's not very sustainable really.
But, so out of all the different models of care that you've done over the years, what has been the one that has surprised you the most that you enjoyed or you learnt from?
So I think certainly group practice. So doing so it was a hospital-based continuity of care sort of model, group practice sort of model. So it certainly wasn't true caseload or anything like that. We sort of worked in a team. And it was when it was sort of fairly new in the hospital system. So, and I absolutely loved the work, as in I loved getting to know the women. I loved, the fact that, you'd build this relationship with the women to the point where the labour and birth was just another day, It wasn't the big be-all and end-all. It was just another part of the process. And, they were just as happy to see you the next day and the day after that, postnatally in their home, that kind of thing. So I loved that aspect of it, but I found, I had two small kids at the time and the on-call really took its toll. You know, that was the hard part. And because it was fairly new in the hospital system, the management of it was all a bit all over the place, you know. Yep. They weren't quite sure how to handle it either. So that was tricky. So it was unfortunate that that, you know, that was the case, because I did love the work, but again, it wasn't sustainable for me at the time, and the way, especially the way it was managed and so on. So I only did it for about 4 years, until I pretty much burnt out a little bit, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, trying to juggle everything, including young families.
Yeah.
That balance is really hard.
And a shift working husband, you know, it was all pretty crazy. But yeah. But that's actually what led me into research. So I, you know, needed a break from group practice. And again, we had very, let's say, questionable management at the time.
Yep.
So when I went to my manager and said, look, I just need a break off group practice, you know, it's burnt me out a bit. My only option that was given to me was to resign.
Oh, lovely. That doesn't help.
Yeah, yeah. So I was not given any other option. I was either do group practice or nothing at all. So I resigned. And I took up a job as a research assistant mm-hmm. on a big asthma and pregnancy study that was happening in the hospital at the time. So I've never done any research before, you know, nothing really that I'd never even thought of doing research. But basically I just needed a job and I needed to not be on call, and this was Monday to Friday and 9 to 5, and that sounded pretty good, and I was still getting to play with pregnant women. So I was happy with that. So I did that, and lo and behold, I sort of started to look at things in a different light, and I recognised that there was this big gap then between, you know, with asthma management in particular and midwives with asthma management. Mm-hmm. Being one myself, I was the same, thinking, well, I've never really asked a woman properly about her asthma, you know, she's doing a booking in visit. Have you got asthma? Yep, tick. You got heart disease? Yep, tick. You know, there was nothing.
But what does it mean?
Yeah, there was nothing more than that. So I could see this gaping hole in, you know, the care and the midwife's role. And so whilst I was still being a research assistant on this other project, I decided I needed to fix that and started a research master's.
Yep.
Looking just at that, at midwifery role or midwife's role in antenatal asthma management, and how we can, you know, what's actually going on and how we might be able to, you know, close that gap a little bit.
How did you explore that?
So I did that by, you know, finding out obviously what was happening currently, what their thoughts were. So I did a survey some mixed method sort of thing. So I did a bit of a survey asking them what they felt their role was in antenatal asthma management, what they knew about it, antenatal asthma, all that sort of stuff. And I also did did some interviews asking them about, you know, their role. So that, you know, showed me that there was still a huge gap going on there, that there was some midwives just said, well, not my job, you know, it's a medical issue, not my job, just refer them on, you know, which was fine, but then there was no referral pathway. So I had to develop a referral pathway. You know, there also was a lack of really knowledge about asthma in pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And then I found that there wasn't even a local guideline on the management of asthma in pregnancy, so I had to write one of those. And obviously no real education for midwives in regards to asthma, so I had to organise that as well. So, yeah, so it was good to, you know, really discover that there was a need for some extra, you know, education and awareness generally.
So what was the bigger research project looking at then? What was
the bigger research project was a clinical trial looking at the use of FeNOs, which is fractional exhaled nitric oxide.
All right, yep.
As a measurement, so which is a measurement of inflammation in the lungs. And so it was trialling women, their asthma being managed based on their FeNO measurement. compared to women just being managed on their symptoms without the measurement. So it was a big clinical trial, and it actually showed at the time that there was a 50% improvement in the women who were managed using the pheno had a 50% less exacerbation rate than the women who were just treated with symptoms. So
that's hugely clinically significant.
It was clinically significant. And then after I did my master's, I then swore never, ever, 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 ever to study again. Ever. And I even put it on Facebook, so it was official.
Right? But you used the never word.
I did. And then, unfortunately or fortunately, the large asthma research group that I was previously working with got some more money to do yet another clinical trial, expanding on the first one, looking at, again, the use of pheno in pregnant women and looking at specifically at outcomes for babies and so on, for women using that as their management. And so then came a PhD to look to help look at the feasibility of implementing that pheno-based management into normal, usual care.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was offered to do that PhD, and I said, no, I'm not ever doing a PhD. I've told you I'm not studying again, but master's was more than enough. And so then they advertised the PhD, and I was like, excuse me, that's my PhD. How dare you advertise it for other people?
It's my lolly. I don't want my lolly. Take the lolly away. That's my
I don't
lolly.
Want it, but I don't want anyone else to have it. So far out. Now I have to do it. God damn it. So very rude. Very rude of them to do that. So, yes. So then there we went. So we went down that rabbit hole. But, look, it was great to, I learned so much. I really did. As hard as it has been, I think, you learn so much about yourself. You learn so many other skills about how to collect data, how to analyze data, how to manage your time, how to juggle 10,000 things at once. You learn so much. Obviously you learn about the subject that you're working on as well. But I think even more than that, I think it's about just learning those other skills that come with a PhD, like project management type skills, really. How to herd cats, how to really get what you need from the people that need to be involved, and really encouraging other people to come along with you on the ride. So, yeah.
How did you go with your supervisor? So because it was part of a pre-existing research team, does that mean then that your master's supervisors then became your PhD supervisors?
No, not necessarily. So one of them did. So one of my supervisors from my master's then ended up my principal supervisor for this project. But then the other ones were allocated, and I actually swapped them out.
Yep.
So I actually found some others that I knew thought would work better for me, and they did. So with my master's, I had a dreadful time with supervisors. I had four principal supervisors in 4 years.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. It was not good. Not good at all.
That's so hard to keep your momentum going.
Oh, it was crazy. Crazy, crazy. And, of course, every supervisor wants to change everything every time. But anyway, we got there in the end, so it was not a happy place. So I was fairly determined to have really good supervision with my PhD, and thankfully that's what I got. And I got fantastic supervision with my PhD, which was awesome. So I certainly attribute my PhD to my supervisors 100%. They absolutely could not have done it without them.
So your master's was part-time, but your PhD was full-time?
Yeah, I started part-time with my PhD because I was still working three jobs as well. and I continued to do that. So I did part-time for about a year, I think, and then I went full-time, just didn't knock it over whilst working three jobs.
How much sleep did you get? Like, what was your study routine?
What's sleep?
Yeah, so what was your study routine? How did you kind of like manage your hours then if you're working so much to find time to study?
Yeah, look, I guess it was just sort of, I don't know, actually. I just sort of do chunks when I could do big chunks. I don't know that I had a routine because I was still working shift work as well. So, yeah. But anyway, we got there somehow. We got there.
So how, if you're working three jobs, you've got your kids were grown up a little bit.
They were teenagers.
Wow. Oh, God. So you've got my old teenage. Okay, so you're going through all of that chaos.
Yeah.
You've got multiple jobs going through. You're doing major trials. You're doing PhD.
Yeah.
How did you keep your sanity? What did you do?
I get up at 5 every morning and I run 5Ks at least. That was it. That's probably it. That's the main thing. And that sort of, I don't know, I solve a lot of world problems while I'm running. so that was kind of helpful in just getting me, you know, up and moving of the morning and, you know, sort of can sort my head out a little bit. I guess my supervisors, like I said, were fantastic, and I did start with another PhD friend of mine. She and I, we both had the same supervisor, so we would go walking with our supervisor at 6 o'clock in the morning. That was our research meetings. and that was really helpful as well.
That was just you and your friend?
My friend and the supervisor.
And the supervisor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, how fabulous is that?
We would walk and then have coffee, and that was our research meeting. So all done and dusted by 7:30 in the morning.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. So that was worked really well. And yeah, other than that, look, you know, I don't know. I'm probably not very sane, really.
Well, there's question about whether we're sanity to start with if we're doing a PhD, isn't there?
Yeah.
How did it go with your family? Because I know that with some studies and some people have spoken about that it is a sacrifice for the family, that you're spending, especially in the final write-up stage and kind of like your temper's short and you're tired, you just want to get it over and done with, especially if you're looking at teenagers.
Yes.
How did that kind of work with your family?
So I really had to sort of, you know, I mean, thankfully my husband is extremely supportive. Like, but I mean, he works shift work as well, so it was kind of tricky. But by the end I had at least one daughter still at home, but I'd taken in a stray, so I still had, I think, two or three teenagers in the house. So I did things like I got a cleaner to come and clean the house once a week or once a fortnight. So I didn't have to stress about bathrooms and floors. And I got, like this when I was writing up particularly, I got, you know, HelloFresh.
Yep.
And it would arrive and then I would tell the children, you have to cook that and eat it or you will starve.
Yep.
And I will have dinner ready, please, by 6 o'clock and you will bring it to me. And that occasionally worked. Didn't work every night.
Good skills for them to learn.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, things like that helped. Like I didn't have to go to the shops because I could just get the food delivered and hopefully get someone to cook it. So just little things like that were helpful in the end there. I guess, yeah, being that little bit selfish, I suppose, in that you just sort of, I just had to say, look, I've just got to sit here and do this. I can't do anything else at the moment. So, yeah. It's tricky though,
And it's because they don't see any outcome for it as well. So
No.
It's hard.
Yeah.
So how did you celebrate?
Oh, well, of course, once I finished, it was in the middle of COVID.
Ah.
April bloody 2020. So I didn't. I went, yay. No one could come and play with me. We couldn't even go out for dinner, nothing. It was right in the middle of a full-on lockdown.
You're due for a few celebrations then.
I know. And even my graduation wasn't until a good year and a half later. So that was good. But even then I didn't even get to go up on the stage. You've got to sort of stand up and sit down.
Oh.
I didn't get to, you know, do anything too exciting. But I got to wear my floppy hat, so that's exciting.
And it does come down to the floppy hat, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely.
Like, I remember when I started and my university still had, for PhDs, had their mortarboard and a different coloured tassel. The medicine had the floppy hat, but the rest of us didn't.
Yeah.
And I remember putting a question into our dean of graduation and kind of saying, look, can we please redress this?
Yes.
Because everyone complains about it. It's not really fair. We want a floppy hat. Bit more political politeness than that.
Yeah.
And she goes, oh, that's a good point. Let me take it up to the university council. Never heard anything, but like 18 months later, the university changed to include a floppy hat.
No.
So well, I'm going, I'm taking that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I initiated that.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And I want the floppy hat, so that was cool. I want to kind of go back to some of the results you found out. So I've just got some of your publications up. And one of the things that you've done and you've published in June of 2019 was looking at antenatal asthma management by midwives, self-reported knowledge, confidence and guideline use.
Mm.
So what kind of things surprised you when you were talking to the midwives about their own knowledge?
Oh, just how minimal it was, I guess, you know, and look, because I had done a full look at the guidelines as well, what guidelines were around, use the agreed tool or whatever it was to yep. assess the credibility of the guidelines. And there's some really good guidelines out there, you know, it wasn't like the information wasn't there, but just the lack of, and this, because I interviewed health professionals as well. As in doctors as well, obstetricians, GPs and so on. And, you know, all really amongst most of the health professionals, they hadn't even looked at the guidelines. You know, what guidelines do you use? Oh, are there guidelines? Well, yeah, there's guidelines, you know.
So the general asthma guidelines of your emergency 4x4x4 type thing and looking at your preventatives versus your or specific guidelines for pregnancy?
Well, even specific guide, well, anything, but even mostly specific guidelines for pregnancy, you know, which there are plenty.
Yep.
And they're not hard to find. So, I guess I was a bit surprised that, you know, of the amount of midwives particularly that said, oh, you know, I didn't think there were any guidelines. Well, have you looked?
But so they just automatically assumed that medical staff would look after that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, you know, medical staff as well, not many of them had looked either. So, which was interesting.
Because when you think about the physiological changes that occur within the body during pregnancy and you're looking at someone who's got asthma and part of that question is how are you managing it? Have you had any extra kind of episodes and how are you breathless? And then do we automatically equate breathlessness to PEs or kind of not thinking of the asthma?
That's right, or just pregnancy. And I guess that was the other interesting aspect of this study was talking to women as well, to pregnant women with asthma, and, you know, their thoughts on it. And really, again, few of them actually even thought it was an issue or had never even thought of it as anything. You know, oh, well, I've had it since I was a kid, you know, big deal, get breathless every now and then, take some Ventolin. And then when they were pregnant, they had no idea of any, you know, correlation, I guess, between poorly controlled asthma and issues with the baby, you know, that it could cause, you know, preterm baby or low birth weight baby or anything like that. So they had no idea that there was that correlation until you say something as simple like as, well, if you're not getting good oxygen in, then neither is your baby. And they're like, oh, gosh, you know, I never thought of that. So, yeah, and there's still a bit of concern, I guess, from women taking medication during pregnancy, you know, and especially when you say something's got a steroid in it, you know. They were like, oh, I can't take steroids. My baby will get too big.
Yeah.
Things like that. So it doesn't make sense, but it's unfortunately how some women think. And then we still had some issues with GPs taking women off their medication as soon as they found out they were pregnant. And so we'd see them when they were, you know, huffing and puffing and, you know, not very well with their asthma and having to, you know, really go on some full, you know, pretty heavy sort of medication then. So, yeah.
So there really is a need for education CPD. It almost needs to be like when we think about it and we think of women who smoke, where if you're not getting, if you're smoking, the baby's getting the smoking. We understand that deficit model. And yet, interesting, we don't necessarily think of it from a respiratory kind of like model as well for asthma. But you'd be thinking that part of the plan of management is, okay, so how are we going to manage that? The body's going to change, your requirements are going to change. If you take too much and have that conversation early.
Yeah.
And yet it's not part of the conversation. So you could make a little fortune selling. It needs to be a yearly update really, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's now a asthma and pregnancy toolkit, which is online. So the Centre for Treatable Traits has helped with Vanessa Murphy, who was my main supervisor. And certainly some of my research has helped build the asthma and pregnancy toolkit. And it's fully available online. You just Google asthma and pregnancy toolkit and it's got some really great information there. It's available to women, to health professionals, GPs, you know, all health professionals. So, and it makes it very clear as to what the recommendations are for pregnancy for women with asthma. So yeah, so that's a really nice output that that's all pretty proud of.
And I'll link to in the when I tag this out, I'll link to that site as well. But when we're looking at how long it takes research to get into practice, and we've got the 15 to 17 year lag, how does it feel to know that you've made a change before you've kind of finished?
Yeah, it's good. It's really good. Yeah, yeah. No, it's excellent. And it was good because the trial that I guess my PhD was sort of linked to, it's called the Breathing for Life trial, and so it actually ended up being a negative trial in that it didn't come up with the outcomes that we were hoping, which means that it then hasn't been implemented as a thing, like the pheno-based management hasn't been implemented as usual care, which was really unfortunate. But, you know, I think it's still, at least having the asthma and pregnancy toolkit out there is still raising the awareness, and, you know, hopefully down the track there might still be some room to implement a different management strategy similar to the pheno-based management. So
you got to start somewhere, hey?
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you're getting 50% of women not having exacerbation, I mean, that's hugely clinically significant.
I know, but their outcomes were surrounding the baby and some neonatal outcomes, and they didn't prove to be clinically significant. So for that particular trial. My part of it, though, was looking at the acceptability and feasibility of the process, and that was really positive. So certainly if we, you know, do another trial or come up with something to prove that it actually really does help, certainly the women loved knowing, because the way it works is that, you know, it gives them a number basically of their inflammation, and so then that they are prescribed medication specific for that level of inflammation. So they're not on too less or too much medication. They feel that they're on exactly what they need to be on, which of course then helps with their willingness to take that medication. And then also when they, you know, get retested and see that that inflammation level has gone down, then obviously that's going to make them feel better about, you know, their asthma and about taking their medication, and that they actually can see that there's benefit in what they're doing. They're not being over-medicated or under-medicated. And
so we're actually having much more better personalised management of care.
Yeah, individualised management, absolutely.
Which is what we want. And yeah, it's interesting, we can use the machines for the CO2 that do the same thing, that give us a number.
Yeah.
But, and that's where you look at the designs of trials. So for that trial, it didn't prove what they were looking at, but someone then goes in and go, okay, well, it didn't do any worse for the the kind of the babies. But if it helps with the management of the mum and it kind of keeps her in a healthier range, keeps her less stressed, then that's got to improve her outcomes to actually get to the birth.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so rearrange the trial and refocus.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But there is a paper coming out hopefully soon too about what the other outcomes were of this trial, even though it wasn't the ones that they were hoping for. There was plenty of others, you know, like I said, that, you know, the awareness and the certainly the women feeling much better managed, you know, that their asthma was much better managed and that they were involved in their care, which I think is really important.
But I think we also need to share the negative results more than what we do, because it's some places and some journals in particular don't want negative results. No, but it's a result.
Yeah.
Which, if you publish out a result, whether it's what you expected or it didn't prove your hypothesis, it's going to stop somebody else from walking down that pathway, and they're going to go, exactly, oh, okay, that road didn't go. Let's go down this road.
Exactly.
We're still learning, we're still sharing, but there seems to be this real dislike of doing the negative.
Yeah.
Because it's almost admitting that you failed. You didn't. You got a result. It just wasn't the one you were looking for.
That's right. Yes. Yeah, there certainly is some, you know, publication bias in surrounding, unfortunately.
One of the other papers and one of the other things that I'm really interested in, I think we might, I don't know if I spoke to you last week about it or somebody else at the conference that we were both at last week, and that's the appreciative
inquiry.
Looking at it from a positive point of view instead of a deficit point of view.
Yeah.
So what got you into looking at using that methodology?
Well, that wasn't on my PhD. That was a separate one. But so that was, again, it was another project that that New South Wales Health was running and involved in, looking at the student midwife experience. So we're looking at, you know, trying to optimise, I guess, the experience of the midwifery students, one, that so that they'll hang around you know, and finish their course, but then hopefully hang around afterwards as well and you know, stay in the workforce. So certainly was driven from a workforce and trying to, you know, ensure that we were, you know, producing, you know, allowing, you know, to educate our students well and that they were getting good experiences in their clinical settings and so on to, you know, help them to stay. So that was a project that I guess I was just lucky enough to be asked to be a co-inquirer on. At the time, I had never really heard of appreciative inquiry at all prior to that. And again, I was sort of in the right place at the right time and asked to put this as another one of my jobs. Yeah, sure, I can do that. And it was fantastic. And so I learned all about appreciative inquiry then, which I do absolutely love it because, yes, it is a strength-based, I guess, methodology. So it doesn't go straight to, oh, right, so what's the problem here and how can we fix it? You know, it really is about what's working well and how can we make that work more often, which I just love. And I even love the way that the data is gathered in that, you know, where, yeah, things like visual imaging, you know, so you put your cards out and get them to pick a picture and tell them or ask them a question and they pick a picture that, you know, explains their answer in regards to that. And the depth of data that you get from, you know, they say a picture's worth 1,000 words. It seriously is, you know. The depth of data, I think, is just so much richer than, you know, because I've done just normal, I guess, qualitative interviews, qualitative descriptive sort of interviews, and now I've done this appreciative inquiry kind of interviews. And, yeah, and I just feel that the depth of data is so much richer. And there are so many other tools that you can use, again, to help gather the data. And, yeah, I really enjoy it. And I just think it's a great way to really get from those that are living it to give you the information and share with you what they're feeling about it as well, not just what they're observing or thinking, but what they're feeling about it. So
what year level were these midwifery students?
All levels. So I interviewed first, second, and third year midwifery students and some grad dip students, and then obviously midwives as well that were working with the students. So, of course, we had the two sort of sides of it, you know, what's your feeling about being a midwifery student working in this environment or in this unit, and then the midwives, how are you feeling about working with the midwifery students? You know, what's working well for you? What could be working better? Those kind of things. So it really got some great information. And then from that has been the ongoing, certainly for New South Wales, has been the development of the mentoring and midwifery program as well.
Oh, using
the same methodology and using appreciative inquiry tools throughout that actual program. So being involved with that has been fantastic as well. So, yeah, so it's something that I'm a little bit addicted to now, the appreciative inquiry, and it's something that I've, you know, included now in my teaching at the university. So it spreads sort of far and wide. So just these little tools, you know, and that was something that I presented at the conference as well. A simple thing like asking someone, you know, asking a group to think about what's made them smile in the last week. Yeah. And, you know, it just changes the vibe, I guess, in the room. It just changes things so simply to, you know, a positive rather than a negative, you know.
I like doing that at the end of sessions, as much as the students kind of find it annoying, but tell me one thing you're going to take out of today that surprised you.
Yes, yes.
And it's like, oh, and then it's like, oh, and then they start thinking about it and it's kind of like, so what surprised you then from what the students said to versus what the staff said?
I guess I was surprised in that I guess I wasn't overly surprised by what the students said, in that I figured that they would have felt in a way a little bit unsupported. Mm-hmm. And that they felt, you know, the simple things, I guess, that really were, you know, worrisome for them, you know, the fact that, you know, people didn't know their name or call them by their name, they were the student, or, you know, no one had shown them where to put their bag on their first day, you know, just little things that are so simple to change and to do to help make their midwifery student experience that much better.
That sense of belonging, so they're not...
Yeah, it is, like, and that's right, because that's what we could do. We mapped this information, this data, to the census framework, which was just a beautiful way of framing it. But I guess what did surprise me a little from the midwives was that they really, really did value the student midwives, and they really wanted to help them to learn and to grow. But they themselves felt that they needed some support. And that's where the midwifery mentorship programs come into play, because, you know, they recognized that they were just getting stuck in the day-to-day grind as well. And so, you know, a midwifery student to them was just another thing that they had to deal with, you know. And so, but underneath, they actually really wanted to, you know, help them, and they recognize that they're our legacy, you know, they're the next ones. We want to retire one day. We need these guys to take on the, you know, and we want them to be good, and we want them to, you know, maybe care for our daughters one day, you know, nicely, you know. So it's that was a really great part of the data that I think we got out of it and what we could use then to build the mentoring program, which has been amazing. So, yeah, so it's great, again, to see that that research hasn't taken 17 years to come around. We got it in, you know, 2018, 19, and now in 2022, 23, it's a happening thing, you know. So I think it's fabulous that we can turn things around fairly quickly.
And that's the, I think that's the miss, not the missed opportunity, but I think that's the unknown in a lot of the small projects, because people seem to think that it's only the really big trials that are going to change practice, not realizing that it can be the little quality improvement that happens on one ward that you share at a conference, you share at a association, and someone else goes, oh, we've got the same problem. Oh, we can chat. Maybe we could do that.
Yeah.
And that's why I think dissemination is so important.
Yeah.
Whatever way, through obviously peer-reviewed journals, but through midwifery newsletters, through journal clubs, or even just sharing around some information, but also including staff from the ground floor.
Yeah.
Of what do you want to improve? Because that buy-in actually helps sustain the kind of the changes that then come through afterwards.
Yeah, definitely.
What are you doing now? What's next? Like, you're still juggling jobs.
I'm still juggling jobs. And look, you know, it is harder, I guess, getting harder once you get into that academia. It's so hard to, you know, teach and research and do it all. Really hard. I really had no idea that it would be so tricky to, I thought I was very good at juggling, but there's just not enough hours in the day. So I'm sort of doing little bits and pieces. I haven't sort of found my next big project sort of thing, or my next big passion. I mean, the asthma and pregnancy thing, I think it's certainly not finished, but, you know, I think we've done a pretty good job there, if you know what I mean. And certainly there's some other avenues that we're still investigating. But I'd like to then come with something else that I'm going to be famous for, you know. I don't know what that is yet.
Well, you've also been involved with quite an alumni of people in the midwives providing women-centered care during COVID.
Oh, yes.
So how did you get involved in that?
Well, that's with the TTMEC. So, again, being involved in that has been amazing to, you know, to just, I guess, ride on their coattails a little bit and, you know, see what can be done with these bigger, you know, national projects, which is just amazing, national and international, involving New Zealand and that as well. So I love being part of that group, and, you know, I'd love to do some more research in whatever area comes up in that. And that's the thing, having all those amazing people.
It, very much so. So for those who don't know, the TTMEC is the Trans-Tasman Midwifery Education Consortium.
Yes.
And at the time of recording this last week, we had a conference, annual or biannual, because it's every 2 years, skips from one side of the ditch to the other. And so it was here in Canberra last week. And, yeah, it's amazing. And I think that was, we were talking a little bit about this before we started recording, that I felt that it was like walking into a room where, regardless of what university we're working at, regardless of where we are in our journeys and hierarchy and all that, it was a group of people who wanted to improve midwifery education.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was one goal. And we were sharing different ways of which we were doing it, and quite happily sitting and talking. It wasn't, well, we can't tell you that because you're over there and you're our competition, because technically we're all competition.
Yeah.
But ultimately we're midwives.
Yes.
Yeah. And we just want to make the midwifery journey the best we can for women in the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for the students along the way, you know, that's what I mean. We want to produce good midwives to be able to, you know, carry on the craft, I guess. And, yeah, absolutely, that's what I loved about that conference, exactly right, that we weren't There was no competition. We were willing to share anything that we'd developed with anyone else. You know, we weren't trying to sell it. We were just like, yay, look at this. Copy it. You know, here's the link.
Exactly. And it's like, yeah, just send me an email, kind of like happily to share things. And I think that's the more open a field is, then the further you're going to go together.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it is about that improvement and it is about that. And acknowledgement, we're all used to acknowledging, we're all used to citing. So none of us have any issues with saying, oh, yeah, you did that or you did that and I got this from this person, acknowledge this person when I write it up. But, yeah, that was, I think that's the fun part about conferences.
Yes, I agree. I agree. That was excellent.
What is, I mean, if you're still looking for your niche for where you want to be, what type of things really tickle your fancy or that you would love to get your hooks into?
I don't know. That's the problem. Because I've got my finger in so many pies, so, you know, part of me still really loves the whole, you know, improving the student midwife experience or the midwifery student experience. So I really love that area and I've just got a few ideas and things sort of happening in that area. But then also I'm a clinician as well. And so, you know, every time I do a shift, I'm like, oh my God, we've got to fix this, you know? And so I get in that area and my head goes down that path, you know, I want to, you know, sort out bloody episiotomy rate and all these kind of things that are going on at the moment. So, you know, so that's what I mean. I'm really hopeless at choosing one thing over the other. And I guess I'm just, it's a matter of sort of seeing what I can possibly do with the time and resources that I have. And, you know, and being open to other things that come along. I have to stop saying yes to everything, however.
Oh, that is not as easy as it sounds, is it?
I know. Very bad at it's like, oh, yeah, look, something shiny. I'll do that. Oh, look, another shiny project.
In fact, one of your nursing professors, Alison Hutton, is amazing, absolutely amazing woman. And I love her to bits. And she kind of, when she used to work over here, and she used to kind of every now and then we'd sit down and have an informal mentoring kind of catch-up session. And it would be like, right, where's your garden? What have you got in your garden? You've got too many pots in your garden. You're not going to be able to look after them all. You're going to have some diet. Now I want you to work out three pots that you can look after properly and then everything else goes out your garden. And that's where your focus is. Yeah. And so you sit there and kind of, okay, there's a midwifery pot and there's a defence veterans pot and there's an LGBTQI pot. So they're my three pots. But within those pots, there's lots of little sub pots that you can kind of simulation and kind of like research and mentoring. And but it is you. It is that hardness because there's so many things that you go, oh, that'd be really good, and oh, that could be really good. But yeah, we do have a limited amount of time. So unless you've got Hermione's time changer,
I know.
I so want a copy. I want
Me
one.
Me too.
But we do. It is really hard to sit and work out how to narrow it down and how to curate your garden so that you're giving quality time. But also I think the biggest thing that we risk leaving out of that garden is ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And academia will take and suck and suck.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And so we're clinical. We are, we're females, we're in a caring profession. We will give everything to our women before we look after ourselves.
Yeah.
And we have to get better at looking after ourselves. Otherwise, we won't be sustainable as a career, as a profession. And we need the young ones to come in. But they're all working out because they're finding it's too much for them in some places.
Yeah,
to keep on burning out. And I'd rather go pull a beer at a pub, get paid the same amount without the burnout.
Exactly right.
Which is sad.
It is. It is.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
It's been a really cool chat.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.